The old Christmas carol tells us to deck the halls with boughs of holly, for this is the season to be jolly. But I have noted with you, I'm sure, a very strange and somber note this Christmas. The energy crunch has taken away all the decorations from the streets. There aren't any bright lights on the houses, and it's a rather dull and gloomy Christmas as you drive around in comparison with Christmases of the past. And I think some of us feel the somberness of this occasion, especially as we read in the papers these chilling stories of cruel and ruthless murders that are taking place in many places today. And we know that famine is spreading in the Sahara, war clouds hang in the Mideast, corruption still occupies the front pages of our newspapers on the political scene, and many people today are asking very honestly, what's there to celebrate about Christmas? Why should we celebrate? Many of you, perhaps, are facing personal sorrow in your own life and feeling pain and tragedy. And despite the joy of family reunions, there's an inner darkness and a pain. I had lunch this last week with a man who told me he had all the outward marks of success. Eminent in his profession, had a beautiful home, a lovely family, all these things that people count as important. And yet he said inwardly he was filled with a constant agony and a sense of self-doubt. And many are feeling this way. Where is the joy of Christmas, they say? Well, for an answer to that question, I'd like to turn to the deepest record of human agony found in the pages of the Bible, Book of Job. The passage that was read this morning to us from the 19th chapter of Job. You know the story of Job, one of the most agonizing records of history, what happened to this man, Job. This is the story of a man who lost all the things that humans count as necessary for the most part in life. All that men count important or worthwhile, this man had, and then he lost. And it's an amazing story of disaster that strikes the human spirit. You remember how Job started out, and we're given a look at the scene at behind the scenes when Satan gains access to this man, and then on a single day tragedy strikes in this man's life, and all the wealth and possessions that he had were swept away in disaster after disaster that hits him. His flocks are stolen, his sheep and camel are gone, his houses are ruined and demolished. And then as a crowning blow on that day, all his children, his seven beautiful children, seven sons and three daughters, all were killed in one tragic collapse. What did I say? All of them were killed on one day. And what a tragic thing that must have been. We read today of families that are wiped out in a single airplane accident and know the heartache and trouble that must bring to a heart. And here is a man who had suffered the loss of his seven sons and three daughters all in one single day. That's 10, isn't it? You can see what a shaking experience is to even recite about it, tell about it. and then, as you know, this wasn't enough. Satan went back to God, and he asked permission to afflict Job personally, physically. And there came upon him a terrible siege of boils, loathsome running sores, that went on for week after week after week. And they're agonizing. Anyone who's ever had a boil or a carbuncle knows how terribly painful it is. And here was a man who had them from head to toe. And he sat in the dust heap. and bemoaned his fate and felt abandoned by all his friends, and even his wife finally reached the end of her endurance and her patience, and she turned from supporting him in his agony and reproached him and told him to curse God and die. Job sat alone in the ash heap and bemoaned the terrible lot that had come to him and saw no reason for it, no explanation of it in his life at all. And to make matters finally the worst they could possibly be, he had three friends who came to comfort him. And they sat there for a week and didn't say anything, which was wise. But then they began to talk, and their argument was all directed in one direction only, that suffering like this can only come as a result of hidden sin in an individual's life, that Job was covering up something. And that unjust accusation just wiped out his human spirit. He just felt himself so unjustly treated. He cries out in his agony to God. Out of that agony comes this painful cry of Job. In the beginning with the 13th verse of chapter 19, he summarizes his difficulties. "He has put my brethren far from me," he says, "and my acquaintances are wholly estranged from me. My kinsfolk and my close friends have failed me." Very ones he looked to for comfort. In fact, just a little earlier in this book, he has called these three friends, "You miserable comforters." And they failed him. The guests in my house have forgotten me. My maidservants count me as a stranger. I have become an alien in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must beseech him with my mouth. I am repulsive to my wife, loathsome to the sons of my own mother. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I loved have turned against me. My bones cleave to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. That is, escaped death by the skin of my teeth. That, by the way, is the origin of that expression that you've used. The skin of my teeth, it comes from Job. "Have pity on me," he cries. "Have pity on me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh?" So he cries out of his anguished heart unto his friends to leave him alone, at least have the grace to leave him alone in his agony and his painful suffering. And the worst thing, I think, as you read this book and get the picture of Job, is his feeling that he can't reach God with this. That even if he could, the greatness of God is such that it would overwhelm him, and he wouldn't be able to even explain how he feels. And he feels this terrible sense of frustration that he couldn't reach to God. So he cries out in the verse 23, "Oh, that my words were written! Oh, that they were inscribed in a book!" Now, Job didn't know that that prayer would be answered, and these words have been inscribed. He's crying out that he might be able to write it down, that someone, sometime, might be able to understand what he was going through. "Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were graven in the rock forever." That's the gloom in which this man lived. As many of us are feeling gloom and despair, perhaps nothing equaling this in any way, but feeling it in this day. Now, suddenly, a light breaks in through this gloom. In the next few verses, you have what occurs several times through the book of Job, that out of the terrible sense of agony and anguish and frustration and weakness and despair and anger which he feels, there is suddenly born a light of hope and of faith. And there are five or six times through this man's cry where he suddenly is helped to see something. And light breaks into his gloom and darkness. And there's a sudden dawning of faith. And this is what you have in the very next verses. For Job then cries out, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side," or by myself, for myself, "and my eyes shall behold, and not another." Then the light fades, and he sinks back into the gloom, and he begins to cry out again, "My heart faints within me." But in the moment here, there has been a brilliant breakthrough of light into his darkness. And in it, Job sees two things, two remarkable things. He sees that the ultimate answer of God to the agony of men is to be a coming to earth of a Goel. That's the Hebrew term that Job uses. A Goel. A kinsman redeemer. A redeemer who would be related to him. You'll find this word Goel frequently through the pages of the Old Testament. It's in the book of Ruth, where Ruth comes out of Moab, begins to glean in the fields of Boaz. And to her astonishment, she learns that Boaz is her kinsman, related to her through marriage, and that he therefore can act as a kinsman redeemer, as one who has the capacity and the ability and the willingness to heal her hurt and change her circumstances and deliver her from her troubles. And you find it frequently in other places in the Old Testament. The idea of someone who's related to us. Now that's what Job saw. He saw the coming of a Goel, a kinsman redeemer, who would have the strength and the ability and the capacity to deliver. And linked with that would be the fact that this would work its way out through a death and a resurrection. And Job sees this. He says, "Then after my skin has been destroyed," that is, this body has died, "then out of my flesh," or apart from my flesh, "I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another." And then the light fades again, and Job sinks back into his gloom. Now, the amazing thing is that in that flash of light, in the midst of the darkness of this man, in his ancient world, there was a revelation of the two great causes of celebration in the Christian faith. Here's the message of Christmas, an incarnation. There shall come a Goel, a kinsman redeemer to earth. And here's the message of Easter, the resurrection from the dead, when the ultimate solution of man's problems will find a relief in the resurrection of the body, and man shall enter into the life God intends for him. Now, on this occasion, of course, we're interested in this first glimpse that Job had. When Jesus came to earth at Christmas, he came as the Goel, as the Redeemer of man, but as the Redeemer who is one of us, related to us. That's the great truth that Job saw in that ancient day. We don't know how long ago Job lived. The book tells us that he was a citizen of the land of Uz. Now, I'm not sure where Uz is. No one is quite. Although I suspect that it's down in that part of the Persian Gulf where the Arabs are now holding all the oil of earth. It's in that section of the country that the land of Uz was located. And Job was a citizen of Uz. And it may be that this is the oldest book in the Bible. Many scholars feel it is. So that far beyond the days of Abraham and Moses lived Job on the other side. And yet looking down across the running centuries, he sees that the hope of man's, of the solution of man's agony is to be the coming to earth of a kinsman redeemer, one who would be related to us. When Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the manger there, the shepherds were told that the one who was born would be a man, a baby, a human being like us, related to us, and thus one who would share our anguish, who would share our pain and our sense of frustration and understand it and know it. And when he came into a world like ours today. I think Sherwood Wirt has captured the mood of that first Christmas very exactly in this description, which I took from a Christmas card I received from him this year. Sherwood Wirt is the editor of Decision Magazine, and this is what he'd put on his inside of his Christmas card. He says, the people of that time were being heavily taxed and faced every prospect of a sharp increase to cover expanding military expenses. Does that sound familiar? The threat of world domination by a cruel, ungodly, power-intoxicated band of men was ever just below the threshold of consciousness. Moral deterioration had corrupted the upper levels of society and was moving rapidly into the broad base of the populace. Intense nationalistic feeling was clashing openly with new and sinister forms of imperialism. Conformity was the spirit of the age. Government handouts were being used with increasing lavishness to keep the population from rising up and throwing out the leaders. How contemporary. Interest rates were spiraling upward in the midst of an inflated economy. External religious observances were considered a political asset. An abnormal emphasis was being placed upon sports and athletic competitions. Racial tensions were at the breaking point. In such a time and amid such a people, a child was born to a migrant couple who had just signed up for a fresh round of taxation and who were soon to become political exiles. And the child that was born was called, among other things, Emmanuel, God with us, the Goel, the kinsman redeemer. Now that's the message that Job saw that illuminated for a brief moment the agony that he was going through. God eventually met this man, and though he didn't answer all his questions, he resolved the conflict within his heart, and the story of Job ends on a happy note. A man came to one of our pastors the other day, just all excited. He said, did you know that Job has a happy ending? And it does have. God met this man. But what Job was permitted to see in the gloom and despair of his heart was the ultimate solution to the problems of human agony, whatever it may be, that one would come who had the capacity to take hold of the problem that hurt, the pain, the heartache, the turmoil, the stress, the pressure, and do something about it. Work it out. But work it out through a process that would well involve, often would involve, a death and a resurrection to follow. This is what Job saw. This is God's process. But he could put his troubles into the hands of one who was capable of handling it. And this is what the message of Christmas ultimately is to us. Last Sunday, I was listening on the radio to the broadcast of the First Presbyterian Church of Berkeley, and I heard Pastor Earl Palmer describe to his radio audience the picture that Rembrandt painted called The Adoration of the Shepherds. Rembrandt's interpretation of the visit of the shepherds to the babe in Bethlehem was a simple scene in a stable. And there in the stable were the mother and the child, and Joseph in the shadows in the background, and peering over into the manger were the shepherds with their sheep scattered around them. They couldn't leave the sheep in the field. They had to bring them right with them. And they brought them. And there the artist has captured the simple scene of these faces looking down into the manger where the babe is lying. And above the manger, arching above the manger, the artist has painted a ladder which suggests in its shadows the form of a cross. Rembrandt was too great a painter to just simply put a cross in by itself. Nothing as crass as that, but there was the ladder that suggested this. And on the beam on which the ladder rested is a rooster, the symbol of betrayal. And the artist is suggesting here that it's by means of the cross, the betrayal, the crushing inner agony of betrayal, and the outer agony of a crucifixion, that the one in the manger would become the world's deliverer and redeemer. But the striking thing about the picture is that the light that illuminates the whole scene is not coming from outside, but from the manger itself, where the babe is lying. There's no halo over the babe, as medieval painters often painted, but the light that illuminates the faces of those looking in is streaming from the manger itself. And their faces are put into sharp relief as they look down, and you can see that it's the light they see is coming from the babe himself. Now that was Rembrandt's very remarkable way of saying that the story of Christmas is the story of light in darkness. As the prophet Isaiah had said, that a light would break out upon those who sit in darkness. And through the centuries since, this has been the heart of the Christmas message, is that there is a light in the darkness of men's experience. All hope shines and gleams from the manger. And men begin to see the answer to their problems in that. For that babe is God's Goel, our Goel, our kinsman redeemer, the one who shares life with us, with its ache, its agony, its pain, its betrayal, its heartache, all that makes up the suffering of men today. He understood, he knew, he entered into. The world into which he was born was a gloomy, dark, hopeless world where men lived in misery, by and large, as the world of our day is increasingly becoming like this. But what they learned and the glorious good news that broke out upon that dark first century was that there was one who was capable of taking whatever problem a human being was involved with and doing something about it. You see, a kinsman redeemer undertakes to work out the solution to the problems all on his own. He only comes into the picture when the person who's suffering or hurt has reached the end of his own resources. As long as a person had resources of his own in Israel, he was expected to use them to help solve his problem. But when you reach the end, where there was nothing left, then you could count on your relatives. And among them would be one who would be the kinsman redeemer, the one who would undertake to be responsible to take you out of that difficulty and deliver you from it. And this is what Job cried out in the midst of his pain. I know that my Goel is alive. And on the earth at last he shall stand. And when the worms have destroyed my body, my skin and bones are gone, then out of my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself and not another. A personal confrontation face to face with the one who was his kinsman redeemer. And this is the message of Christmas. This last week I've heard a half a dozen stories of people who were on the verge of suicide, who had given up, just didn't want to live anymore because of the overwhelming pressures in the world in which we live. And then someone, some Christian, had fortunately been brought into the picture some way or another in various ways, and had told them of Jesus. And there had been that personal commitment of faith that had related them to the story, to the one who had came at Christmas. And the miracle had occurred again, as it's occurred so many times, the restoration of inner strength, the impartation of peace and joy within, and the beginning of a gradual working out in strange and sometimes ways that could never be anticipated of the difficulty and the problem that oppressed them and seemed so insoluble at first. That's the message of Christmas, isn't it? That here we have a Goel who can take our problems and work them out. He will lead through death, the death of our present circumstances, to a resurrection beyond. And all this is ours if we'll have him. All God's blessings and all the victories that he has won are always made available only to faith. You can go through Christmas without him. You can try to work out these problems yourself, if you like, and God will let you do it. But if they bring you to a sense of despair and you still will not turn them over, yield them to the working out of the kinsman redeemer, they will crush you and destroy you. Perhaps your life will be at stake because of it. But if you respond to the story of God, the offer of God, and by faith enter into a personal committal with this one who lives as our Goel and is able to take on the difficulties of our circumstances, you'll find that he, as he's done with millions of others, will lead you out of that difficulty, will give you peace and joy and a sense of oneness with him, strengthen the inner man, and deliver the outer man in his own way and time, as it's happened to thousands of others. Now, I don't know, there may be, well be this morning, many among us here who have been coming to this church for some time, and faith has been awakened in your heart. You've been coming because you feel there is an answer, perhaps to the difficulties of your life and the problems that you're going through. But you've not yet come to that moment of commitment where you hand it over to the one who has the capability of working it out. And if you're that person or you're among them here, I'd like to ask you while we're singing this closing song this morning to just hand over your problems and your life to this living Goel, this kinsman redeemer who's able to undertake for you. And out of the gloom and darkness and despair of your life, hope will be born afresh and anew.